I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
World War, it's not enough. This time can't be for nothing. It's your face, it's not enough.
Hey, hey, this is the Alt in Our Stars podcast, Billboard.com's weekly alternative indie rock, whatever you want to call it, kind of podcast thing. My name is Chris Payne. I'm your host. I'm excited about this week's episode. Had a very, very interesting talk with a musician by the name of Arthur Ashen. He goes by the name on stage of Otra Nova. Believe I said that correctly. That is a topic of conversation during our conversation. He's not even 100% positive on how it's pronounced, but I think we nailed it. I think we have that down. This is a neat talk. We jump back and forth between some very intellectual things and some very silly things. He has a new album out called The Age of Transparency. It's very interesting. It's very good. I suggest checking it out. He's kind of an artist who works in soul and R&B, but you know, he came up playing lots of DIY venues in Brooklyn around punk and noise and metal bands, things of that sort. So he's a guy who jumps back and forth between a lot of sounds, a lot of scenes. It's very interesting all in all. And we talk about how he's sort of a musician who doesn't have one thing that he's a part of and how he likes that. And a lot of talk about music, music theory, playing instruments, that kind of thing. And this one, I learned a lot from it. We didn't get too technical. I think we kept it in the sort of space where you, the listener, can actually learn things, not get too bogged down in boring musician talk. So anyways, hope you enjoy this one. Otra Nova. Nova. I'm getting my French down. Otra Nova on the Alt in Our Stars podcast. Enjoy. Otra Nova.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
But I can't do better. It's not, yeah.
Okay. Shout out to Jesse from 10 Lines Podcast No Effects for giving me, I think, the best guide for how to pronounce your band name, because I was mispronouncing it for ages up until that.
Yeah, it's fine. I'm not a Francophone, so I don't take offense to it. There are other people who are, and they might, but, you know, that's on them. That's their burden.
Yeah. Otra Nova. I think I was saying Otra Nouveau before that.
I always knew it wasn't Nouveau. That was the part that I knew. There was a period of time where I had a DJ moniker. It was Ultra New View. All English language words, but that's because I thought that was how it was pronounced, like Otra Nouveau or something like that.
Okay.
So that was... That was my word game, but I was wrong.
So wait, it was Ultra New View spelled out like an American.
Yeah, like in English.
And did you purposely get Otra Nouveau from that, or is it just like...
No, Otra Nouveau is from... It was engraved on the back of a hat pin at the Cloisters.
Uh-huh.
And the little thing, not pamphlet, what's the word for the piece of paper underneath things in museums?
Oh, the...
Yeah, we're gonna lose
inscription,
it.
Inscription. What is? Because I love words. I want to get this.
Yeah.
Is there a word for it we're missing?
There's definitely a word for it. I just it's totally slipping my mind at the moment.
Because like people who work for museums or intern, their job will be to write those things.
Right, to write and to like create them. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll think of it. But
yeah, we'll come up with it by the end of the podcast. It'll be like the Great Return. So it says it translates to "I want no other," but I've subsequently spoken to a lot of people who speak French fluently or from France or French speaking places, and they all give me shit for how it's meaningless. Mm-hmm. I was 22 when, now I'm not, but when I found it, and it seemed kind of romantic, and I've kind of just been stuck with the name ever since.
Yeah. So what is the, but it's just like a, is it just a coincidence that the DJ name sounds phonetically so similar?
Oh, I named the DJ name after the project.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Other way around. Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
So we've got the origin.
It's like,
story
it's
there.
Yeah, exactly. It's like phonetic, it's phonetic wordplay. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Phonetic wordplay.
Yeah.
So you're out promoting your third album.
Third album.
Age of Transparency.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like you're more winding down at this point, at least North American tours.
Yeah, I've got a gig on the 17th at Pianos, like a kind of small thing. It's a Pictures and Planes thing, which I'm actually looking forward to because I used to play there a bunch when I was coming up, and it'll be nice to be back in that little room.
Yeah.
I think that's all that's on the docket officially for now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Have you gone to Europe or anywhere else outside of the continent yet for this album?
No, not for this album. I think that'll be next year. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess the holidays are real.
True. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What is... I feel like you would... I'm not really basing this on anything, but I feel like you would have a good European following.
Yeah. I've had decent European followings in the past, and then anxiety didn't pop off in the UK, and I don't know why. Neither did my booking agent. We had a conversation about it once that went on too long. Maybe it's because it sounds too much like fake British interpretations of American music or something. It's like they don't need, like, they want to be the ones who are appropriating American sounds as opposed to letting another American appropriate the sounds for them.
Right.
Yeah.
So previously, were you popping in the UK? Because I feel like Anxiety was the album that made you a lot bigger here.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the first record, the only touring I ever did was in Europe. And I would get brought out to little weird art world stuff mostly. And I played the Biennale, the Venice Biennale, and played a bunch in Portugal and a little bit in Spain. I don't know. It was kind of like a cool underground, mysterious American producer thing or whatever.
Okay.
It was. It wasn't like big, but for me at the time, I was like, "Whoa, this is amazing! Somebody's paying me to go to Europe and hang out and perform." So. Mm-hmm.
So it sounded like it was a very specific sort of European show.
Yeah, there's a lot of museum gigs and art gigs.
Huh.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds like a pretty decent place to start.
I mean, I loved it. It was amazing, yeah.
I mean, that beats playing, like, small venues that all sort of are the same in New York.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it definitely beats that.
Yeah. But it seemed like you played your share of the small New York stuff eventually.
Yeah, I mean, I was doing that. I was playing about a show a month in New York from like maybe 2005, 2006 up until, 2011, 2012. That was, I played at Death by Audio and what the hell was that place in Greenpoint called?
Warsaw?
No, it was like, I don't even know if it exists anymore. It was like Botanica, but it isn't Botanica, but it had a name like that.
Okay.
I played at West Nile, which is where 285 Kent opened up, and I played at 285 Kent and played at Glasslands and kind of just like DIY world.
Yeah.
Late era Todd P, although he's still alive, so there's more.
Late era Todd P.
More eras to come, I guess.
The venues, I mean, those venues definitely usually have sort of a time limit on them.
Yeah, I think there are dubious relationships to zoning that happen with those venues. Although the new ones seem to all be on the books. The little ones like Trans Picos and stuff seem legit.
Yeah, He just did, I think it was the first gig ever. It was part of CMJ. It was the Williamsburg Car Wash.
I heard about this, but I was on the road, so I didn't get to go see it.
Yeah, it went over really well.
Is it an actual car wash?
It is, actually.
Yeah.
They actually still, I think it's in some way maybe still an active car wash, because I saw on stage there was like a big advertisement for some sort of like washing products that they use on the cars, mm-hmm. that was on the side of the stage that probably showed up in every single photograph that was taken of a musician on that stage, as if it was sponsored by like whatever that was.
Right.
But
right.
It wasn't.
Yeah. It's the post Red Bull era now.
Yeah. Post even when it's not intended to be a right. sponsor. Yeah.
Just advertise soap for cars.
Yeah. It's everywhere.
Yeah.
But yeah, back to what we were saying, the top P venues, the smaller Brooklyn things. You played one of the last shows at 285 Ken.
Yeah, I think they had four shows that were the last shows.
Okay.
And I think I did the first one. Yeah, that was great. It was really fun. I had some extra friends join me on stage, and it was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Super, super punk. I like having opportunity. Like, basically, you know, 285, now that it's gone, we can all say the sound system wasn't that good, at least not on stage.
Now that it's gone,
we can say this. You know, when you're trying to put together kind of pristine electronics on a stage so that everyone can hear what they're doing, and you don't have proper monitoring, it doesn't really kind of work out. So instead, you just kind of have to do the punk thing and go for it. I climbed up on top of the speaker stack and shit like that, which was fun.
So I saw you recently play Bowery Ballroom, and what is it like now playing more and more venues that have, like, not to diss on Top P and those venues, but having a more legit sound setup?
On stage, it's amazing. I mean, you get to feel like you're inside of a real record, which is like my dream. I'm an audiophile, so I kind of get off on that stuff, but you feel like you have to do everything right in that context too. In a context like 285, you can kind of make more of a mess, which is also liberating in its own sense. I mean, I loved playing that space. That's why I played one of the last four shows, because
yeah,
it was fun as hell, you know.
Yeah. So thinking about that show, it was a couple weeks ago. When the podcast comes out, it'll be like a month ago. So mm-hmm. maybe we won't date it in that way. But that was the tail end of the tour, right?
This is the last tour show, yeah.
Okay. How do you feel that show went?
It felt great. I mean, I've never played Bowery. I've played as an opener or as a headliner at like a number of different venues of that ilk. But I've never played Bowery, and being a kind of New York area local, it was kind of a place that I always wanted to play. Mm-hmm. And so for me, just to be there was fucking awesome. Yeah, it felt good. It felt really good. My new band kills it, and they're all so fucking talented. And, you know, what more can you ask for, to be surrounded by people? It felt like driving a Cadillac, you know? Like, I'm just sitting behind the steering wheel and, like, doing my weird thing, and then everyone else behind me is just kind of keeping all the bumps smooth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because yeah. I guess more in the past, you felt like your weird thing was, I don't know how small your setup was, if it was ever just you, but...
Oh, back in the day, it was me and an iPad.
Okay, so yeah, it was your weird thing, and that was the focus, and that was the extent of it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, for a really long time, actually, for years, it was just me and my iPod backing band, and that was exhausting, although fun. And I went even more crazy because, you know, you have to, every single second, if you're going to be engaging, you have to be doing something, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the backing band now, for those listening, is a backing singer, drummer, keyboards, bass?
Yeah, and the keyboardist also sings okay. as well, yeah.
Okay. So when you do like play by play, the big outro,
mm-hmm.
all the backing vocals, you have a very multifaceted vocal setup for that kind of thing now.
Yeah, for sure. Three part harmonies.
Yeah. Because I think a lot of people would say play by play is their favorite song from you.
Sure.
I think I would say that. I think.
Yeah.
There's a couple on the new album. But that outro of Play by Play is just like a mammoth thing. That's always astounded me, the vocals of that.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I don't know, it's a gospel outro, you know, it's but it's got the comforting slick synthesizers. I don't know, it's really fucking fun to play. I'm not bored of it, and I should be, by all measures, you know. I should be bored as shit. Yeah, you know, live shows are so much about the relationship between you and the audience, or at least for me they are. And when the audience is giving me a lot, then I'm energized, and it's nice to have a song that you can kind of count on to energize you back.
Yeah.
And that's definitely one of them, to get, you know, to be able to stick a microphone into the audience and have them all sing along is fucking insane.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically
it's like childhood dream shit.
Yeah. That's like that fronting a hardcore band at 285 Kent kind of vibe.
Right, exactly.
But playing the kind of music you play and playing it at Bowery Ballroom, it's interesting taking that, because I don't know if like a lot of R&B singers, and I don't even know if you would call yourself that, but I don't know how many people in that style of music are jumping into the crowd, like holding the mic out like a hardcore frontman would.
Right. Yeah, you know, I listen to so much music, and it runs the gamut. So for me, R&B and soul music are an essential part of my history. And you know, what I like about soul music is that so many of the greats, the Al Greens, the, you know, Otis Reddings, the Patti LaBelles, obviously, Whitney Houston, whatever. I'm not going to list all the great soul singers.
There are some great ones.
All four of those are great. They just really sing. And, you know, another genre in which singers really sing is punk and hardcore. You know, they really sing. And so to me, that's the most exciting part about being a vocalist, is really singing, as opposed to like nailing the part. And I admire people who can do that, but that's, to me, the thing that's cathartic and the thing that's exciting is just pushing my vocal cords to their edge and then drinking a lot of tea to make up for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what you're getting at as far as that versus when you just said nailing the part, it sounds like you're placing just like emotion and pouring things out over just like the intricacies of hitting specific notes.
Right. I mean, I think if you hold me up as a vocalist to the standards of other R&B singers, I'm not going to stand up that well. I'm not Usher. I'll never be able to have that type of kind of control. But then there are times that Usher is boring as shit, and it's because he has too much control, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's not even really like a slight on him. That's what he does. It's like how he does it. And when he nails it, it's unbelievable. And it's, you know, like, what's better than Climax or, you know, whatever this, or Sam Smith is unbelievable also. You know, there's a lot of singers that are just great. I guess somebody like Patti LaBelle to me is like the perfect ideal, because she has all this control, but then live, she's this like crazy raging gremlin, and okay. It's like unbelievable. Like, I don't know if you've watched like VH1 Diva shit on YouTube or back in the day, but she hits these notes that are like ugly and beautiful at the same time, and that to me is so inspiring. And I think I've always been like the Otis Redding gutta gutta na na na's and things like that, when people are just kind of pushing the edge of their voices, that's inspiring to me.
Yeah,
for sure.
And I feel you there when you said it, things can be less interesting when it's too clean.
Yeah.
Because it's like R&B and soul, I've been interested in it for a while. It's never been like my top go-to genre.
Sure.
And what I'm drawn to is more stuff like your stuff that's a little bit maybe weirder, a little bit more out there, more just, like you were saying, just singing rather than that precision.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I have admiration for both. But for me, as a singer, I'm not interested in trying to be technically the best. I'm interested in building a skill set as a vocalist to allow me to be able to do certain things that maybe other people can't do, but like really just it's about emoting.
Yeah.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah. And it's interesting. Do you, because it's like with your kind of music, I was just thinking about like those last 285 Kent lineups and seeing the poster with Ultra Nouveau on it. Stylistically, it's so different from like so much of what you play with. Do you ever feel like out of place?
I mean, I feel like, honestly, at this point, especially with the new... Well, I mean, if you take into consideration all three of my albums, like, I'm at a place with literally anyone that I play with. You know, like, the first one's, like, kind of weird lo-fi, hypnagogic soul music with, like, reggae overtones, and then Anxiety is kind of digital, more R&B pop kind of thing. And this new one I just think of as kind of like a shit show of sculptural sounds and kind of pop hooks woven in and out at random times. But yeah, I mean, it's that to me is fun. Like, I like came up in Brooklyn, a lot of the shows I was playing were noise shows, so like with people tweaking Behringer mixers to, you know, overdrive and just make tons of noise, or DJ Dog Dick like doing his weird kind of noise rap screamo thing, and my buddy Dan, who does One of Tricks Point Never, but he had some older projects that were kind of like synthesizer drone things that he would do, and so I always was at a place, you know, I was like always this kind of weird performance art thing in the midst of noise shows, so I'm used to it. That to me,
yeah,
it's fine. Yeah,
yeah, it's like probably people are going to have a hard time if they're trying to put you on a bill of sound-alikes,
right.
or stuff like that. But the scene, your surroundings, I think it's very, very conducive to people being out there and just being different.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the good thing that the internet brought to music is that people don't necessarily feel as strongly about genre as they used to.
Yeah.
They don't like jump on a genre taste thing and stick to the ethos and the ethics of like the kind of weird imposed ethics of what that means to like just punk or like, you know, just R&B or like just rap music or like just rock or whatever.
Yeah, if you look at your Wikipedia page, the first genre has PBR&B.
Right. That one I'm not feeling.
No.
Mostly because I've probably had two cans of PBR in my life, but yeah, you know, whatever. It's you know, you get the world decides you're a hipster, and then and then you make soul music, and you're a hipster, and you're PBR&B. There's nothing you can do about it, you know. It's like one of those things, like vaporwave or whatever, these micro genres that mean almost nothing, and it actually references like a specific period in time in relationship to a specific handful of musicians.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, what are you gonna do if that's what I am? That's what I am, right?
That's an interesting way to put it. It's more of a purity in time than a sound.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Because when I think about, like, Witch House was kind of that, and Chill Wave, all these things. Yeah, that makes sense. It's more just, like, what some blogger was feeling then. Or...
Right, right. No, I mean, it's like, you know, if you're that blogger, like, that's your goal, is to come up with a thing that you can say you coined for the rest of your life, which is good, you know? I tried it with Failure Pop. That's what I labeled my own project about six or seven years ago at this point, and it never picked up. I couldn't get anyone else to be in the failure pop genre.
I was going to say, I am new to failure pop.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone is. I'm advocating strongly for it, but you can't.
What else do you think would fit into failure pop?
I had a thesis that was mostly actually about artists whose careers were predominantly in the 70s, starting to work with synthesizers in the 80s and 90s. Like Stevie Wonder, and I guess it was just stuff that I loved from the 70s, being then Marvin Gaye, like their late era records, and the way that they were kind of approaching this new technology and not really knowing what the kind of norms were going to be, and like weird shit that kind of came out of just letting synths and drum machines roll. And at this point, none of it seems weird because we've had another synthesizer drum machine renaissance, and so like we're just going through the same motions again, and tropes are less obvious than they used to be, but in 2006 it seems like a really great idea.
I mean, I'm not very knowledgeable at all about like the later period of those artists you just named. So they kind of like stumbled around trying to work their legend into new technology.
Yeah, I mean, Electric Light Orchestra. I mean, a lot of like every band that was big in the 70s, they had all these, you know, the music industry was booming, right? Mm-hmm. And they're all making these rock records or these soul records, and they're all using normal instruments. And it's basically just the kind of end result of the pre-digital, pre-synthesis kind of era of music.
Yeah.
And they start hearing new wave, or I don't know, who knows what the hell was going through their heads, but they're like, oh, I want to start fucking with those tools because they're cool and they're what's new, and they're all in their 30s at this point. And so like, let's start experimenting with these tools that we have access to. And some people figured it out and ended up establishing the tropes. You know, Michael Jackson didn't stumble through that transition at all.
Some nailed it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not even that there's anything necessarily wrong with it. It just is that history decided that the way that they implemented those tools was not the way you're supposed to. You know, the same thing happened with kind of like Marcus Popp, who basically invented Glitch. And Glitch is not even a thing at this point, really, but like the kind of early pre-IDM thing was that he took Aphex Twin's ambient records and cut them up and recorded the playback of those CDs and made a new record with that. And that ended up kind of defining the way that a whole slew of electronics were used, not just through IDM, but through today, like the way that we disrupt, like a digital clip is like, we don't even notice it happening or at this point. And then DJ techniques all do the same thing too. So it's just kind of figuring out who did things right or who did things wrong is, and those are in scare quotes there.
Because a lot of it's just like what critics said or what did well on the charts kind of dictates what we say now or who are the winners and
right.
who are
the
losers.
Right, exactly. And so anytime new technology comes up, it's, I guess, failure pop includes those people who are experimenting and failing.
Yeah.
failing to like be to pass the test of kind of new technology implementation or whatever.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting because the broader thing there is just when a new thing catches on, like you said, synthesizers. Mm-hmm. Now I'm not exact, maybe it's something similar now with just like EDM culture or just like ongoing hip-hop culture kind of that's what runs the top 40.
Right.
So now it's like more like alternative artists, more like what rock bands feel the need to be more like beat based.
Totally. Yeah. No, it's all, there's always going to be paradigms that people who don't naturally fit into that are going to experiment with it. So it's like it's the in betweens, like the music and the margins that like doesn't succeed, I guess.
The music in the that sounds like something.
Yeah.
The music in the margins. Like a TED Talk or like a column on something.
Yeah, hire me, Billboard.
Music that was pushed to the side, that yeah. time forgot.
Right, right.
Underappreciated, right. Underdogs.
Right, right, right.
We should talk about... We touched on the tour. I want to talk about the band a little bit more.
Sure.
Wanted to ask... because you talked about playing solo just mm-hmm. with an iPod and moving mm-hmm. up to a band now. What is it like keeping a band together over time?
Teaching
them all that goes into that.
Yeah. All of the people in my band have their own projects that they do as well, and they are totally self-sufficient artists. It's not, I in theory could hire anyone to be my band, but I've been really lucky in the sense that my drummer and the primary vocalist, Joe Stickney and Chrissy Jo Zambri, have been with me for like over 3 years now. And that was what we were touring on, the Anxiety Tour stuff, was just the trio. What is it like? They have to feel like they're engaged and they're excited about it and that they're doing stuff that they want to do. You know, it's just like any other job. You have to make sure that the people, if you're like the employer or whatever, you have to make sure that your employees are happy.
Yeah.
Right. I try and pay them as well as I can when I can, and take them out to dinner when I can't pay them that well. yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I don't know if keeping a 5-piece band together is as easy. We just did this one leg as the 5-piece. It's the first time, and it requires more rehearsal, and it requires, you know, for the years after Anxiety came out, we did a few rehearsals on the top of it, and then like we didn't need to rehearse ever again, which is great because they're just both excellent executors. I don't know. I mean, if I switch out a bass player, then I'll need to rehearse again.
Yeah.
That's what it's like. Yeah.
I mean, I always think like, wow, I'm in the audience. I'm getting like a great representation of the sound with this expert band, but I'm always thinking like, wow, it must take so much effort to keep that all that I'm seeing. Yeah. It must take so much effort to put that together.
Well, you know, like, I've been lucky to just find awesome musicians. And awesome musicians can do anything. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you're good at what you do, like, if you're a great bass player, you're a great drummer, it doesn't take that long. You just kind of, like, listen to the music, write some charts. Within a week, you're playing it as well as you need to. You know?
Yeah.
And it's sick, because I'm not that kind of musician. I'm, like, an ideas guy. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Like, for me, it's, like, the studio is great and, like, very much in the Brian Eno tradition of studio as primary instrument. And I can sing, you know, different things, but it's, the band learns it fast.
Okay.
It's really great.
So you don't see yourself as that kind of like a musician's musician with the instruments, but how'd you learn to sing?
I've been singing for forever. I have a little bit of like pseudo-classical training in voice stuff. I took lessons when I was younger and was in choral choirs for years and years and years and years. But I started singing since I could talk. It was one of those things where, like, my parents would have kids' music on in the car or whatever, and I'd be sitting in the back seat and just, like, singing along to the guitar sounds. And, like, I've always been attracted to the idea of using the voice to do things that the voice isn't supposed to do. I don't know. I mean, singing through repetition, just like anything else. It's not Malcolm Gladwell, but it's the 10,000 hours.
Yeah, yep.
Right.
For the genius, the 10,000.
Yeah, mastery.
Mastery.
Not genius. Genius is a whole other thing.
Yeah, I've read, I just read the Outliers is where that comes from. Mm-hmm. That one, his recent stuff, I've never tried to read it because it just seems kind of hokey.
Right.
But that book, I've picked up a lot of interesting things from that.
It seemed hokey to me too, that one also.
That one even. I mean,
I've flipped through it. I've been gifted his books on multiple occasions.
And okay. Some friends trying to inspire you.
Right. Mostly family. I also received The Secret as a gift once. So, and Eckhart Tolle, all sorts of, I guess I have family members who like cults.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Scientific cults or otherwise. Yeah.
You're gonna get, what was that, the Scientology doc? You're gonna get that one for Christmas.
I hope not. Every time I talk to somebody about it, I haven't seen it. Every time I talk to somebody about it, they're like, "I'm watching this and it actually is freaking me out. Like, it scares me legitimately, and I just don't need the weight of that. I don't need to know about it."
Oh, fuck! I haven't seen it. So
if things are happening on like some sort of like actually terrifying level in terms of Scientology, like, that's just, it is what it is. What are you going to do?
But I think if it's far away and isolated enough that it won't affect you and I could potentially watch the documentary. And even if it is terrifying, I cannot be terrified by it.
Right, but I think the point is that it does affect you and I on some weird level.
What?
I don't know. Have you seen it?
No.
Nah, sorry.
Our programmer Jess has not seen it either.
Yeah.
Is that our producer? What is your title?
Producer.
Sure.
Executive producer.
Executive producer Jess has not, or you like Jessica, right? I've heard.
Someone's spreading a rumor that I don't like my name, like what people call me here.
She likes both. She slightly prefers Jessica, but Jess is fine.
Mm.
Yeah.
So we're talking about Scientology. Prior to that, Malcolm Gladwell singing is the topic.
Yeah.
So if I was thinking, if you really wanted to, you could in the press release put classically trained vocalist.
Yeah, but that's not.
I feel like whenever a band has like a violin or a cello or something like that, it's always classically trained.
Right.
Only way. No yeah. one just plays the cello because they picked it up.
No, you don't just fuck around on a cello. It's because the intonation is so hard. I think that's the problem with this, because there's no frets. Because you definitely can just pick up a guitar, but I don't think you just pick up violin or cello. Mm. I don't know. I'm not a real musician, so I wouldn't know these things.
What do you think makes a real musician, then?
Just somebody who has a natural penchant for playing instruments, for reading music, for things like that. You know, I read C++ better than I read music. You know what I mean? Like, I like can go into the back end of my computer before I can go in, go in and like fix a guitar or whatever. So, you know, I guess I know so many people who are so good at playing their instruments, and they can play their instruments like they're a voice or like they're a thing that they're born with. And that to me is, that's, you know, I'm a middling musician, but I work really hard. I work really hard at it.
And that's where the people in your band come in.
That's where the people in my band come in. Yeah. I have like enough musical background to be able to talk to them about it and like kind of explain what I want to do. But I listened to some Michael Jackson like demo tapes, pre-demos of like him just like doing vocal overdubs of all the parts of things off of Bad or off of Thriller. I can't remember what songs they were at this point. So I can do that kind of thing where I can be like, here's how I want the bass line to be, here's how I want the guitar to sound, like here's like what I want the drums to be or whatever. And I can play keyboard fine. Like I'm like a passable keyboard. If there was a band that played fairly straightforward pop music or like indie rock or whatever and needed a keyboardist, I could probably pull that off too. But I could never be a backing vocalist because my voice just like cuts through like a knife, no matter what the context is.
Mm.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Yeah, huh? Yeah, even like, I mean, we're talking about like different like styles of vocals and different ways you can be really good. Like before, we were talking about like the precision versus just like belting, and mm-hmm. I guess this is like another one of those differences.
Right. Yeah. My timbre is too like too idiosyncratic or whatever.
Yeah, I'm trying to picture you like backing vocals in any sort of a band, and it's
No, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. I can like write the harmony parts, and I can sing backing vocals for myself. So on my records, I'll do it. Okay. And usually I think of them as scratch vocals at the time, but they end up getting blended in as kind of to fill things in.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't harmonize with anyone else. Not really. Okay. I mean, I can sing the notes, but I can't. It just like doesn't blend.
And what about like, because you do a lot of vocal improvisation live,
mm-hmm.
I'd say. How did you learn that?
I don't know, man.
Singing in the car to the kids' songs.
From vocally improvising. I can like cite weird games that I, like, I do this thing, like radio game in the car with some friends, where, you know, just scan till the first song comes up, and before you have a chance to really process what's going on, your job is to create a brand new melody to sit on top of that song that, like, shifts the fundamental nature of the song. And that's pretty fun. That's like a fun exercise for just kind of being quick on your feet in terms of melody writing, because the goal is not to fall into the song, right? But it's to, like, transcend the song, and no matter what the hell's happening in the song, it becomes the backing track for the new song that you're writing.
It's like freestyle, like rap freestyling, but for vocal harmonies,
right?
Basically.
Right, yeah, kind of.
Give me a beat and I'll do whatever. Yeah, any beat, it's
that. Yeah, exactly.
Or I'm picturing, like, a bunch of theater kids on the bus to the competition, all doing that at the same time, really, really competitively.
Yeah, that sounds good. I don't know. I was never on that theater kid bus, but it looked like it was fun, you know?
Trying to think of what other kind of, like, musical on the spot improvisations you could do along those lines.
It's the only one I ever thought of. I mean, I do another thing where I listen to like really out avant-garde shit and try and find pop lines within those as well, like Meredith Monk or Merzbow or whatever, and, like, try and find, like, the harmonic overtones that you can use to build melodies on top of that are still linked to the music, which is a fun exercise also, kind of.
Okay. I'm not familiar with in what avant-garde mediums they work, so I don't really...
Meredith Monk is, like, primarily a vocalist, but does a lot of, like, extended technique in any instrument is basically when you kind of push outside of the cultural norms of how to use that instrument. So she does a lot of, like, weird guttural stuff.
Okay.
Joan LaBarbera does similar extended technique for vocal stuff. She worked with Robert Ashley, who's he's an avant-garde opera composer kind of performer. So Merzbow is like harsh noise, like Japanese harsh noise. And it's one of those things where you first hear it, you're like, this is just grating and annoying. But then if you let yourself sit with it and are willing to look for it, you actually hear all these complex overtone interactions that happen. And it's like, it's like My Bloody Valentine without the song underneath.
Yeah, there. Just the noise, right. Just the reverb.
Right. Yeah. So I'll do that for fun, like go to experimental musician friends shows and just in my head be sitting in the audience, like writing pop songs on top of them. I don't know. I like to me, like anything could be the basis of that. And singing is something I do without thinking about it. So that's where I learned to sing, was just by doing it over and over and over again.
Yeah. That's really, wow. That the scene you painted of being at the experimental show and singing having a pop song in your head on top of it.
Yeah.
I was not expecting that. I was thinking just on basic terms of like, say like a band like the White Stripes that doesn't have bass. Like if you were learning bass, picking up a bass guitar and like adding a bass line to a very like minimal song with just drums and guitar.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in a weird way, we all kind of do this. At least I am imagining, I'm generalizing my own experience here, but you know, you hear a song and you like EDM DJs will like put in these subliminal crowd noises at the moments where people are supposed to be psyched. Right. And it's actually built into the productions themselves. And what that does is it's not that all the crowd noise is really there, but it like creates the feeling like you add your own experience on top of the music you listen to. Right. You like, it's probably harder now than it used to be, but like, you know, it used to be really easy to not know what musicians you liked look like. And so you would like project this really like the band Spoon. I was super into Spoon in college, in early college and in high school. And I just imagine he was just this really like handsome, cool dude. And it turns out, he's fine looking, but he's just like a kind of gangly redhead, you know, and like does not like have a, like, he doesn't like look cool. And I just imagine he was just like super suave and that he just like.
Brian Ferry is like what you were.
Right. But instead, it's just this like kind of like gangly redhead nerd stunner. And
I think Britt from Smith is very good looking within that archetype.
Right. But to me, he like totally failed to fulfill the expectation. And this is not like a slight on Britt Daniels at all. It's just more like I had this whole other image of like what kind of guy he was. Maybe even like a more handsome Lou Reed or something. You know what I mean? Just kind of more rugged or something like more New York City or something. And I think we all do that to all the music we listen to. So it's just, you know, whatever the hell you spent a lot of time thinking about. Music to me is no longer like a social thing. It's more of like a technical thing. So when I hear sounds, the way that my imagination is piqued is not by like imagining some like person doing this or like imagining like the social context in which I'm at a huge outdoor festival and there's a great light show or whatever, but it's like imagining the different ways that a musical idea can be changed and recontextualized, because that's just like a more fun exercise for me. Then I like can kind of distinguish how somebody made things, and so it takes the romance out of it, the cultural romance out of it, and it's more just like, how do you put romance back into music is by making it like a game.
Yeah, because we know so much about music now. It's so at our fingertips. It's like, yeah, how do you put that mystery that draws people in, how do you put that back?
I mean, it's still there. I mean, people seem to still have it. You know, I think you and I are probably, we probably know too much, you know?
Yeah, I would say so.
but there are, I think most people who like music don't know that much and they're happier for it. And like part of me could wishes that I could go back there.
How quaint. Those faces in the crowd who just don't know.
They don't know how manipulated and easy it is.
It's all
a scam.
They don't know how to fret the cello, and they don't know how put the take the avant-garde music and find the pop melodies.
No, it's not. It's not a limitation. It's like a great blind spot, I think. I mean, I grew up being a music fan, you know, and I miss it. I miss that kind of fandom.
Cool. That's about all I had at my end.
Sounds good.
To talk about. Yeah, that was really fun. Thanks for coming by.
Yeah, thanks for having me, dude. I appreciate it.
For sure. Cool.
Let's have it peter out.
Yeah. So that concludes another episode of the Alt in Our Stars podcast. Thank you so much for listening, however you are listening to this, whether it's on iTunes, on your iPhone, at your desktop, at your friend's house, whatever. Thank you so much for listening. I appreciate it so much. As you can maybe tell, I really enjoyed doing this podcast. If you have any kind of feedback from me, I really appreciate to hear it. Good, bad, middle of the road, whatever. You can give us a star rating on iTunes. That's very appreciated. If you have any specific feedback, you can email me. It's chris.payne@billboard.com, chris.payne at Billboard, or on Twitter at cpayne on a plane. And yeah, if you want to subscribe to the podcast, totally should. You can click on the iTunes link towards the bottom of this story if you're viewing it on billboard.com. That is, it's in the last graph. If not, just search for Alt in Our Stars on iTunes. In podcasts, you can subscribe there. Also, archived episodes, lots of cool stuff to dig through. We've had, we've had Magical Clouds, Bully, The Wonder Years, Ashley Monroe, Tom Mullen from Washed Up Emo, all on the show lately. So, stuff to cull through there in the archives. But new episode runs every Friday around 12 noon, 1 p.m. on billboard.com. So, keep a lookout for that. Subscribe. Until next week, people, have a good weekend. Bye-bye.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.